So we're here today with Dr. Josh Cowan of Michigan State University. You may be wondering, if you are a regular watcher or listener of this show, you may be wondering why I am interviewing a professor at a Michigan university, but I believe that will become clear in just a moment. Dr. Cowan, welcome to the state of Kentucky.
Thank you so much. Happy to join you virtually.
We are excited to have you. So you are an education expert. You have done evaluations of programs. You have led a policy group about education. But specifically, you have a book coming out that I think it really applies to our state. What is that book?
That book is called The Privateers: How Billionaires Created a Culture War and Sold School Vouchers. And it's coming out from Harvard University Press in September. And basically, it tells the story of how a small group of fairly wealthy conservative funders sort of decided that 30 years ago, we needed school vouchers across the country and created a pathway to do that, both through the courts, through legislation, and then through think tanks that kind of created a motivation and created data and analysis to kind of make the case for these things. And really the take-home point, though, is why we are having this conversation today, why states like Kentucky, states like Tennessee, Texas, Arkansas, Georgia, Pennsylvania, states all over the country in the last 18 months have had to deal with these things in their legislatures. It's not a grassroots parent movement. It is and always has been driven by nationally focused groups that have decided this is the key policy priority for them.
And of course, the reason that we're interviewing you here is that we have a constitutional amendment on our ballot this November to allow funding of charter schools. And of course, if that passes, then vouchers will certainly be right behind. Yeah. I was fascinated in reading about your book, which, by the way, I'm going to pre-order. I was fascinated reading about your book that you use the phrase evidence-based. And one of the things that continually comes up in the discussion of charter schools is that there is evidence that they work really well and that they help with educational equity and income inequality and all these things. And yet it seems from the pre-publication blurb about your book that you didn't find that to be true. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, it's important to draw a big distinction here because you correctly pointed out that some of the issues facing Kentucky voters this fall will concern both charter schools and also school vouchers, and they're a bit different. So charter schools are publicly run schools in the sense they follow the same rules for the most part as traditional public districts, but they're independently operated. So they're not operated by, you might have a standalone school that is its own entity, but they are public schools. The voucher system, and really this is what the target of these groups is using public dollars to offset private school tuition. Mm-hmm. And that's the end goal for most of these groups. And the reason it's important to draw that distinction isn't just because they're very, very different, because one is public school, albeit independently managed, and then that's the charter schools. And then the voucher side is using taxpayer dollars to fund K-12 tuition. There's mixed evidence on charters. So where charters seem to work are where they are in usually large districts, very, very large districts, where the public schools have struggled. Like, no one's saying every public district has hit it out of the park every time, and there's lots of historic struggle around the issue of equality, both financial and race related. So there's been some charter schools that have been pretty decent in some urban environments, especially where there's strong oversight and accountability, and where those charter schools have to follow the same rules that their other public counterparts have to. On the other hand, for vouchers, for taxpayer-funded private school tuition, especially over the last decade, the results are just absolutely dreadful. Kids who move from public to private school suffer some of the worst declines in academic outcomes we've ever seen in the education research record. And those are just the 25% or so who kids who actually do move from public to private. The vast majority of voucher users have already been in private school before getting that taxpayer bailout for tuition. And that's really important because you're going to hear over the next few months, folks listening to this conversation, you're going to hear a lot of proponents of this constitutional amendment saying we need to change Kentucky's constitution to allow taxpayer dollars to offset private school tuition to provide hope and opportunity and scholarships for kids in Kentucky who are trapped in failing schools. That's what they say in Kentucky, in Tennessee, everywhere where they try to push these things. And the reality is, most voucher users are already in private school to begin with. And really, what this is it's essentially a tuition forgiveness system that's being pitched to Kentucky voters as a new opportunity for their kids and families.
One of the issues you mentioned large urban districts, and of course we have in Kentucky we have the Louisville slash Jefferson County system, Jefferson County Public Schools, widely known as JCPS, and there are some interesting contrasts within that school system. I live in that school system. My children went to that school system, and on the one hand, you have a school like, say, Manual, that usually has about 30 merit scholars a year. And then you have other schools where obviously students are struggling and it's a real, issue. And yet the state legislature wants to, what they want to do is split up JCPS completely because they don't like the teachers union. But they use the excuse of, well, it's going to be better for all these black children who live in the West End of Louisville. And it sounds like what you're saying is that that is really a talking point only and is not necessarily backed up by any evidence.
So here's what you have to remember about these voucher schemes that are going to get pitched here to Kentucky voters this fall. When it comes to vouchers, it's not actually school choice, it's the school's choice. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is none of the voucher systems that have passed other state legislatures, which would happen if the constitutional amendment does pass in Kentucky, none of them require private schools to take any of the children just who are publicly funded to change their admissions practices, to keep kids they do admit. They can get rid of them for any reason whatsoever and call it their school's mission or values. One thing I'll say, I started my career at the University of Kentucky. So I spent a number of years earlier in my career in Lexington. And, I think sometimes when voucher advocates push these bills, they for listeners that know the Lexington area, that the these voucher lobbyists will talk as if every kid's going to get a coupon to go to Sayre School, to the Sayre School, or to Lexington Catholic. That's actually, and those are good schools. But that's not the typical school that takes voucher payments. It's usually a school that's financially distressed, barely hanging on. They will take whoever comes to the door for the most part because they need the money. And that's what actually is driving that they're awful results for kids. When we actually look at who is allowed into these voucher schools from the public schools, they'll what tends to happen is there's a big marketing campaign after these things pass. They try to get as many kids to leave public schools as they can. And again, only about a quarter of the users total of these voucher schemes are coming from public schools. Most are already in there. So it's true that maybe there's a couple of kids at the Sayre School or at the Lexington Catholic that might qualify for the voucher or might get the voucher, but they're already there. And that's why you see these things really mostly funding kids who are already there. And so it's really, really important to pay attention to kind of some of the marketing of this because no one, what they'll tell you is that this is about providing hope and opportunity and new educational choices for kids who need them. And what's really going on is this is about tax breaks for families who are already in private school.
The issue that I think some Kentucky voters may not be aware of is that the legislature, specifically the Republican conservative majority in the legislature, has been pushing for charter schools for some years, and in fact has passed legislation around both vouchers and charter schools, and they've been struck down by the courts because our Constitution has a very strong piece of language that the funding can only go for the system of common schools. And of course, That goes all the way back to the Rose decision, which
Yes.
started the Kentucky Education Reform Act. And so what they want to do is ignore that. They want to change the Constitution, and they use the word notwithstanding, notwithstanding that that's in the Constitution, we want to do this anyway. So one of the fights we have had here for years now is about charter schools, and there have been a lot of horror stories shared about various charter school systems and charter schools and so on and so forth. So let's leave vouchers for just a minute and talk about charter schools. You mentioned that they seem to succeed when they have strong public oversight. Can you tell us then the opposite? What are the conditions by which we should be watching for charter schools to come in that are really bad?
Yeah, look at the two states to the north of you. So the state of Ohio and then the state that I'm in right now, Michigan. Michigan and Ohio have some of the largest, I think it's the top two largest proportions of charter schools run by for-profit companies. That in my state it's 85% of the schools are run by for-profit companies. In Ohio, it's a little less than that, but those tend to be the schools that perform really poorly. And part of what's going on there is we don't really know how that money gets spent. So what happens in the for-profit charter industry is states have some type of public entity, like it's usually a university or a school district itself, is allowed to what's called authorize the charter school. And that's a little bit like a school board. It doesn't have the authority of a school board, but it's like a school board in the sense that it's a body of something, again, a district, a university, whatever. But then they contract out to a vendor to manage the day-to-day of the school, and that includes hiring the teachers. Now, we know that by far the single most important factor in a kid's success within a school, whether it's public, whether it's private, is the teachers that work with them. Teachers are doing a lot of great work. But when you have that process entirely outsourced to these firms that are trying to save money, make profit margins that are not available to taxpayers, by the way, no one really knows what the profit margin on those schools are. I mean, you don't have to be to have an MBA from Stanford or something to know that most firms are going to try to maximize profit and minimize cost. And so what that means is in the states that we're able to even know what they're paying teachers next to nothing. They're scrimping on instructional services. The money they do spend on instructional services, often it's renting curriculum materials owned by the for-profit entity itself. So what you have is the for-profit entity renting to the school and to the authorizer, the district or the university, its own materials. In my state, we're having a real problem where these for-profit organizations actually purchase the school buildings, old school buildings from districts that have had to consolidate, or they'll rent space in like old, I don't know if Kmart ever made it down to Kentucky. I can't remember when I was there, but old Kmarts, old strip malls that schools will rent space in, fix it up a little bit with some paint. And then they'll charge the authorizing district or university rent for their own property. And that's where they make a lot of the profit here. It's a pretty seedy set of circumstances that no one knows fully about. And so one of the really big things that would happen in Kentucky, the really big choice that would help determine partly the success or failure of these things is to the ex what will the legislature allow in terms of contracting out to these for-profit vendors. If they allow a lot of contracting out to these vendors, it's going to be an absolute disaster for kids who use those schools. If it's thought of more as like, well, we're going to have a nonprofit run the school and they're good faith folks, and sometimes they're working directly with the district that's authorized them. Sometimes they're working with, say, UK or Louisville, to kind of develop best practices and figure out how to make it work, then there have been some success stories in that type of environment. But it's really different than just cutting a check for, say, 900 grand to a firm to run a school on the cheap for 75 kids in the Louisville area and saying, stay out of our way. We're going to educate these kids. It's a very, very different market. And notice that the sort of the moral of the story there, and what it does have in common with vouchers, is generally the more privatized all this gets, the worse the results are.
One of the things that we have brought up repeatedly when we've been talking about charter schools is that unlike the school choice movement where students get to pick their school, these are often situations where the school gets to pick their students and they don't necessarily take, they're not required to take any student that is in their district or that walks in the door or whatever the case may be. So I've been subbing in the JCPS system, doing band and orchestra primarily, but I recently was asked to sit in a classroom for one period before my regular classes started. And I said, "So what is this class?" And they said, "Well, you don't have to worry. There's a professor up there from the university who runs the class. You just have to be in the room." And so I went up there, and it was a room full of special needs children, some of them with significant special needs. And here was a professor and an aide, and they were working with all these children, from what I could tell, very effectively. And I just thought to myself, what private school has this capability?
Kids who need special services, the reality is they need a lot of support. And whether public or private, my view is that our educational system in general, public, private, charter, whatever, doesn't do enough to help those kids in general. And yet, as you pointed out, public schools do have, at least on paper, the obligation to do so. Whereas the private schools especially can completely turn them away, and by simply saying we don't offer those services. So without getting into the weeds of federal law when it comes to special students with special needs, the bottom line is every child under federal law is allowed to have, is due, is owed free and appropriate education is the phrase. And when and within the geographic residence that they live in, and that usually means the school district. So what happens when these voucher systems scale up? So I want to be clear here, and one of the reasons I'm sort of struggling with how to explain this is there are some pretty good programs that use a voucher type system specifically to underwrite the cost of special needs education for attending certain schools that really specialize in it. And if I when I talk to policymakers, legislators, reporters, whoever, about areas for compromise, that's one of the things that I'll point to sometimes is say, there are Ohio actually has something. It's called John Peterson Scholarship. There are schools that specialize in services for kids. Our state here in Michigan runs a school for the deaf, for example. Now it's a public school and it's free, but there are private schools that do provide these types of things. And the way these special needs vouchers work is they help offset that. Voucher advocates and the voucher lobby will try to lump all that in together and talk about it as if it's one thing to show you to push back on the story you're describing and simply say, no, vouchers do help everyone. And the reality is that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about again, private school tuition for just a kids in a what would be normally a general education environment that usually are already there paying tuition. And there are one of the real problems here with what happens when states have been doing this for a while is you start to learn the patterns. So Arizona, for example, is Arizona and Florida have the biggest, most comprehensive, most permissive voucher systems in the country, meaning basically everybody gets a voucher if they want one. The only requirement is you can't use it to offset public school stuff like aftercare or something, but you can't be enrolled in public school, but you can use it to do anything else: homeschool, big screen TV, and call it a homeschool expense. Private school tuition. You can go to Disney World and call it a field trip. I mean, they really do this. There's been national reporting on this. But one of the things that's happened in that environment is you've got consumer protection oriented folks. For example, the Arizona Attorney General has been issuing warnings and echoed what the Federal Government Accountability Office, Federal Watchdog Agency, has echoed too, which is these private schools don't all do a good job explaining to parents that they give up their services when they attend those private schools. They'll kind of muddy the waters a little bit. The good faith private schools, and again, there are plenty of good faith operators out there. They'll say, listen, we just don't have the supports for your severely dyslexic kid or your your kid with Down syndrome or something. So we just don't have the supports for that. But others will say, come one, come all, you know, we don't meet the federal IEP, but we do almost as good. And what parents don't necessarily understand is that they give up a lot of their disability rights when they take those schools. So what's been happening in some of the states where you do have parent-friendly and consumer-friendly public officials who care about these things is they've been issuing fraud warnings. And they've been taking the logic of all of this to its important conclusion, which is, listen, okay, if we're talking about this market for consumers, and we're just going to say parents are like speculators on an open market, shopping around for the school they want, we're going to start to impose consumer protections into the space. And the most important of those consumer protections is these schools can lie to you and get your dollars, and then you are left without any recourse. And we need to do a better job warning parents about that. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
So are there states or even districts where they've gone down this path and realized that it's a bad path or and not working and have backed up? Are there places where they have said, no, we don't like this and we're going to undo it?
This is the danger is once they get the foot in the door, these things almost always spread, and they spread quickly, and they eat up first public school budgets. So the money that can get spent on your public school system, and then other services too. The only state that's really repealed anything like this is Illinois, which in January allowed its voucher tax credit system to expire. The tax credit version of this was something that the voucher lobby tried to ram through your state by taking it to the state Supreme Court. I believe it was at the end of 2022, and the court wasn't fooled. In an important ruling, they said, listen, and I can get into the weeds of what a tax credit version of this is, but basically they said a tax credit version of a voucher system has the same effect on public revenue as a voucher system itself, and so it's unconstitutional. But next door in West Virginia, for a very similar constitutional provision and a very similar tax credit, that Supreme Court said, okay, it's fine. And so the important piece here is, you know, one of the reasons they're doing this constitutional end around in your state is they're just not going to bother trying to deal with a court. They're going to try to kind of just go to voters and push these things through. But the problem here is once it happens, except for that one state in Illinois, where the legislature just said, no, thanks, we're letting this thing expire. Mostly these things spread and they consume a bigger and bigger portion of taxpayer dollars as they do spread.
When we had the tax credit discussion, I found that most of our readers and listeners did not really understand the difference between a deduction and a credit.
Yeah.
And well, so I kept doing articles about, no, this is not like a charitable deduction. This is a give back.
So what happens in the tax credit version? This is what was in place in Illinois, or excuse me, in before your court there, and what got repealed in Illinois. And it's an important thing to sort of remind folks, because we don't know exactly what the structure will look like if the constitutional amendment were to pass and then a new bill would go to the legislature. So it's important to be watchful for both of these. But the tax credit version is, it allows particularly wealthy individuals, but technically anyone, but mostly it's corporations and wealthy folks like Betsy DeVos in my state, to write a check for what they owe to the state instead to deposit it into a fund that spends voucher money on tuition, mostly again for kids who are already there. So what the Supreme Court in Kentucky said was, losing that, let's pretend Betsy DeVos lived in Kentucky, losing that source of tax revenue from Betsy DeVos, who's now putting what she owes Kentucky taxpayers into a voucher scheme, that has the same effect on the budget for the Commonwealth of Kentucky that just simply writing the same dollar amount check directly to tuition for those kids has. That your court found that has the same effect on revenue. That's correct. That's, you know, whether or not I spend $500 or I get $500 taken out of my paycheck, I'm $500 poorer at the end of the week is the way this works. And they have the same effect. So, you know, I think a lot of times there's one of the tricks these folks use is to try to confuse the issue, as you mentioned, and to try to kind of make it seem everybody sounds like a tax credit. That sounds great. And there are some really great tax credits out there, for example, the child tax credit, you know, which allows families to help pay for their own childcare expenses. But it's really, really different than a tax credit that allows wealthy individuals to, and my guess is it would also be allowing wealthy corporations in the state, in your case, to instead of paying into the general fund, in Frankfurt, they're paying into a voucher fund that then cuts checks for parents who are already in private school.
So, as we wrap this up, if you were standing on the doorstep of a voter in Kentucky, what is your, elevator pitch about why they should vote against this amendment?
Well, changing a state constitutional amendment is a radical step. And if you're going to take that radical step, it better be worth it. It better be worth it in terms of cost, and it better be worth it in terms of the outcomes you get for that cost. And for any of these schemes that we've talked about today, voucher schemes in particular, they're wildly expensive. They benefit mostly kids who are already in private school. Their parents are already spending the money to send those kids to private school. And for the few kids who do leave public to private school, their academics suffer wildly, and they suffer for years. All of that comes at a direct cost to taxpayers, and in the long run, disinvestment from Kentucky public schools. The state can't afford to pay for two systems of education, one to offset tuition for, again, kids already in private school in Kentucky, and two, typical Kentucky public schools. It can't, in the long run, the state can't do it. And so, you know, right now in your state, the constitutional prohibition against these schemes is the only thing keeping this from happening right now. Perhaps Governor Beshear will veto it, but my understanding is that there's a lot of authority the legislature has to override vetoes and things. So, the Constitution itself in the Commonwealth of Kentucky is the only thing that's protecting families from these schemes. And you know, why would you ever want to take the radical step of removing that last protection from stopping this from happening?
Excellent. Dr. Josh Cowan of Michigan State, author of The Privateers, which I will include a link in the description below so people
Appreciate that.
reorder it if they want. Thank you so much for your time and for your insights. We may be in touch again, depending on how this all goes.
Sure. Stay safe, stay vigilant, everybody.
Thank you.